Welcome to the deep dive. Ever wondered how you and maybe a tomato plant fight off the same kind of enemy viruses?
It's a great question. They seem so different, but the challenge is universal, isn't it?
Exactly. We've sifted through a whole load of research and articles, and our mission today really is to pull out the most surprising, the most useful bits about viral defense in both us humans and in the plant kingdom.
Right. We want to give you those aha moments, get the key insights without getting bogged down in the excessive jargon.
Yeah, get straight to the good stuff. We'll unpack the clever ways these two, well, very different life forms handle this common threat.
You'll definitely see some surprising similarities, but also some really unique tricks each has evolved. Think of it as your shortcut to understanding this fundamental biological battle.
Absolutely. We'll explore our own multi-layered defenses first, the ones keeping us healthy, and then dig into how plants actively protect themselves. It's really quite something.
And yeah, we've looked at a range of sources to get a balanced view, from the real nitty-gritty cell stuff to the bigger picture strategies.
Our goal is pretty simple: give you the core knowledge, the essentials of how humans and plants stand up to viruses.
So before we jump in, what comes to mind for you when you think about fighting viruses? Is it just white blood cells or?
Yeah, probably white blood cells, maybe antibodies. But plants? I guess I haven't thought as much about how they do it. Let's dive in.
Okay, let's start with us humans. Our defense against viruses is, well, it's incredibly sophisticated. Think of it like a security system with multiple layers.
Right, like a castle with walls and guards.
Exactly. And that first layer, the innate immune system, it's all about immediate sort of general protection. It's there right from the start, ready to go.
And a big part of that is the physical stuff, right? Barriers.
Absolutely. Things we barely notice. Our skin, for instance, is just a fantastic physical barrier. I mean, unless it gets damaged, like a cut.
And inside, we've got mucous membranes too.
Yep. Lining our airways, our gut, urinary tract. And they're not just passive walls. They actively secrete substances that fight microbes.
Like lysozyme in tears, I remember hearing about that.
That's a perfect example. It breaks down bacterial walls. It's like a natural disinfectant wash for our eyes.
Wow. And there are others.
Oh, yeah, loads. Think about your stomach, super acidic. It basically incinerates a lot of the viruses and bacteria we swallow.
Right. Kills them off.
And then you've got enzymes from the pancreas, bile from the liver, in our digestive system. They all join in. Even the fact that our intestinal cells constantly shed helps physically remove microbes.
It's like a constant cleanup crew.
Pretty much. And don't forget the simple mechanical actions. Coughing, sneezing, that's the body forcefully ejecting stuff from the airways.
Like saying, get out.
Exactly. And the flushing action of tears and urine, constantly washing surfaces. Even things like nasal hairs and earwax act as traps.
It's quite a setup.
And one more thing for this first line. Our friendly bacteria, the commensal flora in our gut and elsewhere, they actually help by competing with harmful microbes for space and food.
So they're part of the defense team, too.
Definitely. They make the environment less welcoming for invaders.
Okay, so these barriers are crucial for stopping viruses right at the entry point. But what if some get through?
Ah, well, that's when the cellular cavalry of the innate system arrives. We've got different types of immune cells ready for immediate action. Phagocytes are key.
Phagocytes, like Pac-Man cells.
Sort of, yeah. Neutrophils and macrophages, they're the engulfers. They literally eat viruses, debris, anything foreign they find. They patrol and rush to infection sites.
Like little vacuum cleaners.
That's a good way to put it. And then there are natural killer cells, NK cells. These are really interesting.
Why is that? What do they do?
What's cool about NK cells is they can spot and kill our own cells that have become infected with the virus, and they don't need to have seen that specific virus before.
How do they know which cells are infected?
It's complex, but they basically recognize cells that are showing signs of stress or are missing certain self-markers. They have these things called cytotoxic granules inside them.
Granules, like tiny bombs.
Kind of. They contain proteins like perforin and granzymes. When an NK cell finds an infected target, it releases these. Perforin punches holes in the target cell membrane, and then granzymes go through those holes and trigger apoptosis.
Apoptosis. That's programmed cell death, right? The cell self-destructs.
Exactly. The infected cell basically takes itself out cleanly, preventing the virus from spreading further. It's a very controlled demolition.
Clever. And how are these NK cells activated?
by distress signals, basically. Cytokines like interleukins and especially interferons, which are released by infected cells or other immune cells, can activate them. They can also work with antibodies in a process called ADCC, antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity.
Wait, antibodies? I thought they came later.
They mostly do. with the adaptive response. But some antibodies, specifically IgG, can stick to infected cells, flagging them. NK cells have receptors, called CD16, that recognize these flagged cells and kill them.
So the early and later responses can work together sometimes.
Absolutely. And NK cells aren't just one uniform type. Research shows they're quite diverse, with different subsets maybe specializing in different things. Some can even form a type of memory for certain viruses, like CMV.
Memory, like the adaptive system.
Sort of memory-like functions, yeah. Faster, stronger responses upon re-exposure.
Yeah.
And interestingly, even something basic like having enough iron is important for them to work properly.
Wow. NK cells sound incredibly important for that initial fight.
They really are. They're vital for controlling viral numbers in those first crucial hours and days before the really specific adaptive immune system gets fully mobilized.
Okay, so we've got barriers, we've got patrolling cells like macrophages and NK cells. What about the soluble stuff, the humoral components?
Right, these are molecules circulating in our blood and tissues. The big ones here are the complement system and interferons.
Complement system sounds complicated.
It is a bit of a cascade, yeah, like a series of dominoes falling. It involves over 30 different proteins in our plasma that work together in a precise sequence.
And what does this cascade do against viruses?
Several things. It can directly neutralize viruses, preventing them from infecting cells. It can trigger lysis, basically punching holes in infected cells using something called the membrane attack complex, or MAS.
Another hole-punching mechanism.
Yep. And it can also coat viruses and infected cells, a process called opsonization, which makes them much tastier for those phagocytic cells we talked about, easier to grab and eat.
So it helps the cleanup crew.
Exactly. It amplifies other defenses and gets activated a few different ways, classical, lectin, alternative pathways, but they all kind of funnel down to activating key components like C3b and forming that MAC attack complex. There's even some cool new research about complement proteins working inside ourselves, the complexome.
Inside the cell too. Wow. Okay. And interferons. You mentioned them activating NK cells.
Right. Interferons, or IFNs, are signaling proteins. When a cell gets infected, it releases interferons, almost like a screen for help, especially type I interferons like IFN-alpha and IFN-beta. They're triggered strongly by things like viral double-stranded RNA, which is often produced during virus replication.
And what's their main job? Interfering?
Pretty much, yeah. They interfere with viral replication. They activate enzymes inside cells that chop up viral RNA and others that shut down the cell's machinery so the virus can't use it to make its own proteins.
So they try to stop the virus factory.
Exactly. And crucially, they also signal to neighboring uninfected cells, telling them to prepare their defenses. It creates an antiviral state in the surrounding tissue, limiting the spread. Plus, as we said, they boost other immune cells, like NK cells, so they're key early responders.
Okay, this innate system is really impressive. A lot going on immediately. But sometimes viruses still get a foothold, right? That's where adaptive immunity comes in.
Precisely. The adaptive immune system is the second wave. But it's much more specific. And importantly, it creates memory. It takes longer, maybe days, to fully develop, but it provides targeted, long-lasting protection. The main players are lymphocytes, B cells, and T cells.
Let's start with B cells. That's humoral immunity, right? Antibodies.
Correct. Humoral immunity revolves around B cells and the antibodies they produce. When a B cell encounters a specific viral antigen, say a piece of the virus's coat protein, often needing a bit of help from T helper cells, it gets activated.
What happens when it's activated?
It multiplies like crazy and differentiates. Most become plasma cells, which are basically antibody factories. They churn out huge amounts of antibodies, all specifically designed to recognize that exact bit of the virus the B cell first saw.
And these antibodies, how do they actually stop the virus?
They have several strategies. Neutralization is a big one. They physically bind to the virus, like coating its spike proteins, and block it from being able to attach to and enter our cells.
Gum up the works.
Exactly. They can also cause agglutination, clumping virus particles together, making them an easier target for those phagocytes to clear away.
Makes sense. Easier to clean up a big clump.
Right. And opsonization, again, coating the virus, makes it more attractive to phagocytes. Plus, antibodies can activate that complement system we talked about, bringing in its destructive power.
So they're like targeted markers and weapons.
You could say that. And here's the crucial part for long-term protection. Some of those activated B cells don't become short-lived plasma cells. Instead, they become long-lived memory B cells.
Ah, the memory aspect.
Yep. Yes. If you encounter the same virus months or even years later, these memory B cells are ready. They recognize it instantly, multiply rapidly, and start pumping out antibodies much, much faster and in larger amounts than the first time around. That's your secondary response.
And that's the basis for vaccines, right? Creating that memory.
Exactly. Vaccines introduce the viral antigen safely, triggering this primary response and generating memory cells without causing the actual disease. It pre-trains your adaptive immune system.
Okay, that covers the B cell and antibody side. What about T cells? Cell-mediated immunity.
Right. T cells are the other arm of adaptive immunity. They mature in the thymus gland. There are two main types crucial for fighting viruses. Cytotoxic T cells, also called CD8 plus T cells, and T helper cells, or CD4 plus T cells.
Cytotoxic T cells, the name sounds ominous.
Yeah, the killers, yes.
Oh, yeah.
They specialize in finding and destroying our own cells that have already been infected by a virus.
How did they find them? It's not like the infected cells were a sign.
Almost. Our cells constantly display little fragments of proteins from inside themselves on their surface using molecules called MHC class I. Think of it like a window showing what's happening inside. If a cell is infected, it'll display fragments of viral proteins in that window.
Ah, okay.
Cytotoxic T cells have receptors that are specifically looking for those viral fragments displayed on MHC class I. When a T cell finds a match, it knows that cell is infected.
And then killer mode.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It latches onto the infected cell and releases those same cytotoxic molecules we saw with NK cells, perforin to make holes, and granzymes to trigger apoptosis that programs cell death. It also releases cytokines to call in more help.
So targeted elimination of infected cells. What about the T helper cells, CD4 plus F?
T helper cells are more like the coordinators, the generals. They don't kill infected cells directly. Instead, they recognize viral antigens presented by other immune cells, like macrophages or B cells, on different display molecules called MHC class 2.
Okay, so they get the message from the scouts.
Kind of. When activated, T helper cells release a whole range of cytokines. These signals are crucial. They help B cells produce more and better antibodies. They boost the activity of cytotoxic T cells. They recruit more macrophages. They basically orchestrate the whole adaptive response.
So they amplify and direct the fight.
Precisely. And just like B cells, some activated T cells, both cytotoxic and helper, also become long-lived memory T cells after the infection is cleared.
More memory.
Yes. These memory T cells allow for that much faster and stronger response upon secondary exposure to the same virus.
So this ability to remember, this immunological memory, is really the defining characteristic of the adaptive system.
Absolutely. It's what gives us long-term, often lifelong, protection against many viral diseases once we've recovered or been vaccinated. That primary response takes time, maybe a week or two to peak, but the secondary response is much faster, often within days, and much more powerful.
An incredibly powerful learning system.
It really is. A multi-layered, adaptable, and memorable defense.
And speaking of memory and vaccines, the COVID-19 pandemic really hammered home how vital they are.
It certainly did. SARS-CoV-2 caused such a huge global upheaval, and vaccines were absolutely critical in, well, getting things under some level of control and reducing the terrible toll of severe illness.
Let's quickly recap how that virus, SARS-CoV-2, actually gets into our cells. It's all about the spike protein, isn't it?
Primarily, yes. It's an RNA virus with this characteristic spike glycoprotein covering its surface. That spike protein is the key. A specific part of it, the receptor binding domain, or RBD, latches onto a receptor on our cells called ACE2.
ACE2, I remember that. It's on lung cells.
Lung cells, cells lining blood vessels, gut cells, yeah, quite a few places. Think of a spike RBD binding to ACE2 as the virus grabbing the doorknob.
Okay, so it grabs on, then what?
It needs a little help to get inside. An enzyme on our cell surface called TMPRSS2 acts like scissors. It cuts the spike protein at a specific spot. This cut causes the spike protein to change shape dramatically.
Ah, a conformational change.
Exactly. This change allows the virus's outer membrane to fuse with our cell's membrane. And once they fuse, the virus's RNA genome is dumped into our cell cytoplasm.
And then it takes over the cell's machinery to make more viruses.
That's the goal. So that interaction spike protein, ACE2 receptor, TMPRSS2, that whole entry mechanism, became the prime target for vaccines and therapies.
Makes sense. Target the key that unlocks the door. And the variety of vaccines developed was just incredible, wasn't it?
Astonishingly fast development and deployment of several different types. We should probably touch on the main ones.
Let's start with the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna. They were kind of the front runners.
Right, a really novel technology. They don't contain any actual virus. Instead, they deliver a set of genetic instructions, messenger RNA, wrapped in a tiny fat bubble, a lipid nanoparticle.
Instructions for what?
Instructions for making the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, specifically in a shape that's known to trigger a good immune response. This mRNA gets taken up by our muscle cells at the injection site. Our own cell machinery reads the mRNA and starts manufacturing the spike protein.
So our cells become temporary spike protein factories.
Exactly. These spike proteins then get displayed on the surface of our cells. Our immune system sees them, recognizes them as foreign, and mounts a response making neutralizing antibodies against the spike, activating T cells.
And the mRNA itself, does it stick around?
No, it's quite fragile and gets broken down by the cell relatively quickly. And critically, it never enters the cell nucleus, so it can't interact with or change our DNA. It's a very clever way to show the immune system what the target looks like.
Very clever. Okay, what about the viral vector vaccines? Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca.
These use a different delivery method. They take a harmless virus, usually an adenovirus that's been modified so it can't replicate or cause disease, and use it as a delivery truck, a vector.
Delivering what?
Delivering the genetic code for the spike protein. Sometimes it's DNA, which then gets transcribed into mRNA inside our cells, and then translated into the spike protein. Same end result. Spike protein gets made, displayed, and triggers an immune response, antibodies, and T cells.
So a different vehicle, but the same cargo instructions, essentially.
Pretty much. Then you have protein subunit vaccines like Novavax.
How do they work? Sounds more direct.
It is more direct. Instead of delivering instructions, they deliver the actual spike protein itself or fragments of it that have been purified. These often come mixed with an adjuvant.
An adjuvant? What's that?
It's a substance added to help boost the immune response. Sort of wakes up the immune system and tells it to pay attention to the protein fragments. The immune system sees these foreign proteins, makes antibodies, activates cells. The usual adaptive response, no genetic material involved, just the protein target.
Right, just showing the target directly. And inactivated vaccines like Sinopharm, Sinovac.
This is a more traditional approach. You take the actual SARS-CoV-2 virus, grow lots of it, and then kill it, usually with chemicals or heat, so it's inactivated. It can't cause disease anymore.
But the parts are still there.
Exactly. All the viral components, including the spike protein, are preserved. So when it's injected, the immune system recognizes these various viral bits and mounts a response. Often needs multiple doses for strong immunity.
And briefly, attenuated vaccines.
Those use a live but significantly weakened version of the virus. They usually give a very strong, long-lasting immunity, but because it's live, even weakened, it's generally not suitable for people with compromised immune systems. Not a major strategy for the widely authorized COVID vaccines.
So a whole arsenal of approaches, but all aiming for the same thing, right? Train the immune system.
Absolutely. The common goal is a robust, specific immune response against SARS-CoV-2. Primarily, inducing those neutralizing antibodies that block the virus entry by targeting the spike ACE2 interaction.
And activating T cells, too.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Activating cytotoxic T cells to kill any cells that do get infected and helper T cells to coordinate everything and boost antibody production.
Yeah.
And of course, the ultimate goal is generating immunological memory.
Memory B and T cells.
Right. So if you encounter the real virus later, your immune system is primed for a rapid, powerful secondary response that prevents severe illness or hopefully any illness at all. Those adjuvants in the subunit vaccines really help kickstart that memory development, too.
Now, effectiveness against variants. That became a big story. The virus kept changing.
It did. The initial vaccines were highly effective against the original strains. But variants like Delta, and especially Omicron, had mutations in the spike protein that made it harder for the original vaccine-induced antibodies to bind effectively. So effectiveness against infection dropped.
But did they still protect against severe disease?
Yes. Importantly, protection against severe illness, hospitalization, and death remained quite strong, though it may be slightly reduced compared to the original strain. This led to the development of updated vaccines.
The bivalent and newer monovalent ones.
Exactly. Vaccines specifically targeting the spike proteins of the circulating variants, like Omicron subvariants. Getting these updated shots helps generate antibodies that are better matched to what's currently out there, broadening protection.
And what's this idea of imprinting?
Original antigenic sin, or imprinting. It's the idea that your first exposure, whether to the virus or a vaccine, kind of shapes or imprints your immune response. Subsequent exposures might preferentially boost the memory response to that first version. It's complex, but sometimes this might actually lead to broader immunity over time, even against related viruses.
Interesting. So overall, the impact on reducing severity was huge.
Undeniable. data from everywhere showed massive reductions in hospitalization, ICU admissions, and deaths among vaccinated people compared to unvaccinated across all age groups. They significantly lessened the pandemic's burden, reduced transmission to some extent, especially of severe disease, and helped protect the vulnerable.
So vaccination was and remains a cornerstone of managing COVID-19.
Without a doubt, a crucial public health intervention. Staying up to date is still important.
Okay, truly remarkable science in action there. Now let's completely shift kingdoms. Let's talk plants. How do they fight off viruses? It seems like a totally different ballgame.
It is different in many ways, but plants have their own sophisticated defense systems too. No T cells or antibodies roaming around, but they're definitely not passive victims. We can think about their defenses in terms of innate immunity, RNA silencing, and systemic acquired resistance.
Innate immunity again, like our first line.
Yes, they have their own version, often described as a two-tiered system. The first tier is called pattern-triggered immunity, or PTI.
Pattern-triggered. So they recognize patterns on the virus.
Exactly. Plant cells have receptors on their surface, pattern recognition receptors, or PRRs, analogous to ours. These PRRs recognize general molecular patterns found on many microbes, including viruses. For viruses, these PMPs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns, could be things like viral coat proteins or single or double-stranded RNA.
And when a plant PRR detects a viral PMP,
it triggers an alarm inside the cell. A signaling cascade starts, leading to various defense responses.
Like what kind of responses?
Things like producing reactive oxygen species, toxic molecules, changes in ion flow across membranes, activating defense-related genes, and producing defense hormones like salicylic acid. They can also deposit callus, a substance that can physically block the connections between plant cells trying to trap the virus.
So trying to contain it locally and fight back chemically?
Right. It's a kind of general early defense. But viruses, of course, try to counter this.
How?
Viruses produce effector proteins. They inject these effectors into the plant cells specifically to suppress PTI and help the virus establish infection.
Ah, the arms race continues.
Always. But this leads to the second tier of plant innate immunity, effector-triggered immunity, or ETI.
Okay, what's that?
Plants have evolved intracellular resistance proteins, often called R proteins. These R proteins act like internal guards. They're specifically designed to recognize those viral effector proteins that are trying to shut down PTI.
So the plant detects the virus's counterattack.
Exactly. And when an R protein detects its corresponding viral effector, it triggers a much stronger, faster, and more targeted defense response than BKI.
Stronger how?
Often, ETI involves the hypersensitive response, or HR.
Hypersensitive response sounds dramatic.
It is. It's essentially rapid programmed cell death right at the site of infection. The plant cell basically sacrifices itself, and maybe a few neighbors, to prevent the virus from spreading any further. It contains the infection by killing the host cells the virus needs.
Wow, cellular suicide as a defense strategy, that's pretty hardcore.
It's very effective at limiting spread. Salicylic acid, that defense hormone, is also really important in regulating the HR and restricting the virus. So ETI is a highly potent, specific response triggered by recognizing the virus's own weapons.
Okay, so PTI is the general alarm. ETI is the specific, often drastic counterattack. What else do plants have? You mentioned RNA silencing.
Yes, RNA silencing, or RNA interference, RNAi, is a hugely important antiviral defense in plants, and actually in many other organisms too, including us to some extent.
How does it work against plant viruses?
It primarily targets the virus's genetic material, its RNA. Many plant viruses have RNA genomes or produce double-stranded RNA during replication. Plant enzymes called dicer-like proteins, DCLs, recognize this viral dsRNA and chop it up into small pieces, about 21-24 nucleotides long, called small interfering RNAs, or siRNAs.
Okay, little fragments of viral RNA. Then what?
These siRNAs get loaded into a protein complex called RISC, the RNA-induced silencing complex. The RISC complex then uses the siRNA fragment as a guide. It patrols the cell, finds any longer viral RNA molecules that match the sequence of the siRNA guide.
And destroys them.
Exactly. RISC essentially slices and dices the matching viral RNA, effectively silencing the viral genes and stopping the virus from making more copies of itself or spreading. The plant can even amplify these siRNAs to make the silencing stronger.
That sounds incredibly precise, like a molecular search and destroy mission targeting the virus's blueprint.
It is very sequence specific. But again, the arms race. Viruses fight back. Many plant viruses produce viral suppressors of RNA silencing, VSRs, which are proteins designed to interfere with various steps in this silencing pathway.
Trying to disable the plant's weapon system.
Exactly. It's a constant battle at the molecular level.
Fascinating. And the third thing you mentioned was systemic acquired resistance, SAR.
Right. SAR is more like a whole plant alert state. After a plant fights off an initial localized infection, perhaps using HR or other defenses, it can develop SAR. This means the entire plant becomes more resistant to subsequent infections, not just at the original site.
Like the plant gets primed or immunized?
Sort of, yeah. It's a long-lasting, broad-spectrum resistance. That defense hormone, salicylic acid, SA, is key here too. SA levels increase throughout the plant after the initial attack, triggering the expression of various defense genes, including pathogenesis-related PR proteins that have antimicrobial activity.
And it works against different types of pathogens.
Yes. SAR can provide enhanced resistance against a broad range of attackers, including different viruses, bacteria, and fungi. It's like the plant puts up its shields everywhere. It's considered a form of systemic immune memory in plants, though different mechanistically from our adaptive memory.
That's really cool, a whole body readiness. Now, given how much we rely on plants for food, how do we help them fight off viruses? Can we immunize plants?
That's a huge area of research in agriculture, obviously. Viruses cause massive crop losses. So yes, there are several strategies to bolster plant defenses or provide immunity.
Like what? Traditional methods first.
Yeah, traditional breeding is the oldest method. You find individual plants within a crop species that happen to have natural resistance to a certain virus, often due to specific resistance genes, those R genes we talked about. Then you crossbreed those resistant plants with high-yielding or otherwise desirable varieties.
Selecting for resistance over generations?
Exactly. It takes time. But it's been very successful for many diseases. Nowadays, we can use molecular markers linked to those R genes to speed up the selection process that's marker-assisted selection, MAS. But it's limited by the available resistance genes within crossable species.
Okay, so harnessing natural variation, what about genetic modification?
Genetic modification opens up more possibilities, potentially faster, and using resistance traits from sources you couldn't normally breed with. One of the early successes was coat protein-mediated resistance.
Using the virus's own coat protein, how does that work?
You insert the gene for the viral coat protein into the plant's genome. When the plant expresses this viral protein, it somehow interferes with the replication or assembly of the actual invading virus. It confers resistance to that specific virus and often closely related ones. It's been used commercially in things like squash, papaya, potatoes.
Amazing. Using a piece of the enemy against itself. What else?
Enhancing that RNA silencing pathway we discuss is a major strategy. It's called host-induced gene silencing, or HIGS.
Supercharging their natural defense.
Pretty much. You engineer the plant to produce specific small RNAs like siRNAs or artificial microRNAs that are designed to perfectly target essential genes in the virus. When the virus infects, these engineered small RNAs direct the plant's own RSC machinery to destroy the viral RNA much more efficiently.
Tailor-made RNA weapons.
Exactly. Very effective and specific. And then there's CRISPR-Cas technology.
The gene editing tool. How's that used for virus resistance?
A couple of ways. You can design the CRISPR system to directly target and cut the virus's own genetic material DNA viruses with Cas9, or even RNA viruses, using enzymes like Cas13. Basically shredding the viral genome.
Direct attack on the virus genes.
Or you can use CRISPR to precisely edit the plant's genes. If you know which plant genes a virus needs to hijack for infection or replication, maybe a receptor it uses, or some host factor it needs, you can edit that plant gene to make it non-functional or unsuitable for the virus.
Making the plant itself inhospitable to the virus.
Right. CRISPR offers incredible precision and versatility for engineering resistance.
Are there non-genetic approaches too? Chemical immunization.
Yes. Research is exploring chemicals that can trigger the plant's own defenses, essentially priming them. We mentioned salicylic acid is a natural signal. There are synthetic compounds too, and natural ones like N-hydroxypipecolic acid, NHP. Applying NHP to plants like tomato or pepper has been shown to activate SAR, making them broadly more resistant. It's like giving the plant a defense-boosting shot.
A chemical vaccine, almost.
In a functional sense, yes. And one last thing, virus-induced gene silencing, VIGS. This isn't for making resistant crops, but it's a key research tool. Scientists use a modified, harmless virus to deliver genetic material that silences a specific plant gene. It helps them figure out what different plant genes do, including which ones are involved in defense.
So a whole range of tools, from breeding to gene editing to chemicals, all aimed at protecting our vital plant resources.
It's a critical field for food security.
Taking a step back now, comparing humans and plants, it's striking. Same threat viruses, but such different toolkits, yet some common principles seem to emerge. What are the big similarities?
Well, both fundamentally rely on innate immunity as that first line. Both use physical and chemical barriers. Both use pattern recognition receptors, PRRs, to detect those conserved molecular patterns, the PMPs, on the invaders.
Recognizing the enemy early.
Right. Both employ programmed cell death apoptosis in us, the hypersensitive response in plants, as a strategy to limit spread by sacrificing infected cells. And that systemic acquired resistance in plants, SAR, while mechanistically different, has functional parallels to our adaptive immunity in providing broader, lasting protection. And RNA interference is a deeply conserved mechanism used by both.
So common strategies like detection, barrier, sacrifice, and system-wide alerts, what about the biggest differences?
The most obvious is the lack of mobile immune cells like lymphocytes and a true antibody-based adaptive immune system with memory in plants. Plant immunity is much more cell autonomous. Each cell has to do more for itself.
No roving patrols or antibody factories.
Right. Plants have unique defenses, like strengthening their cell walls or producing specific antimicrobial chemicals called phytoalexins. And the role of plant hormones, salicylic acid, jasmonic acid, ethylene, in coordinating defense, is much more central than hormonal control in our immune system.
So more localized defense, chemical warfare, and hormonal signals in plants versus mobile cells, antibodies, and memory in us.
That's a good summary of the key distinctions.
Right.
It reflects their very different lifestyles and body plans, sessile organisms versus mobile ones.
And evolutionarily, this is all shaped by that constant arms race, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a never-ending cycle. Viruses evolve to evade detection or suppression. Hosts evolve new ways to detect or fight back. RNA viruses, with their high mutation rates, are particularly adept at this rapid evolution. It's this dynamic conflict that has driven the evolution of these complex defense systems in both kingdoms over millions of years. Some components might even trace back to defenses in bacteria and archaea.
A relentless evolutionary pressure.
Indeed. Understanding this coevolution is key to predicting future threats and designing durable resistance strategies, whether it's new vaccines for us or more resilient crops.
This has been incredibly illuminating. We've covered so much ground from our own intricate, layered immune system and how vaccines cleverly tap into its memory.
To the surprisingly robust defenses of plants, using innate detection, that elegant RNA silencing, and system-wide alerts like SAR.
And seeing the parallels pattern recognition, programmed cell death, alongside the stark differences, like antibodies versus phytoalexins, is really fascinating. It truly shows how evolution finds different yet effective solutions to the same problem.
Exactly. And it highlights why understanding these fundamental processes is so critical, whether we're tackling a human pandemic or trying to ensure food security by protecting crops.
Definitely brings home the real-world impact.
And maybe a final thought for you listening. Just consider this continuous evolutionary dance between viruses and hosts. How has this ancient ongoing battle shaped the sheer diversity of life we see? And looking forward, how can we use this deep knowledge of defense mechanisms, both conserved and unique, to develop smarter, more sustainable ways to combat viral threats in the future for both human health and agriculture?
Some really big questions to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the world of viral defense.